This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, we review the top stories of 2016. Hello again, I'm Carol Castillo. From the turbulent U.S. election to the fall of Aleppo, it has been a year of surprises and setbacks. Another story which confounded pollsters and pundits was the British vote to leave the European Union, also known as Brexit. Donald Trump's unexpected victory over Hillary Clinton in the U.S. election and the determination by the U.S. intelligence community that the Russian government was not only behind the illegal hacking in the U.S. election, but did so to benefit Mr. Trump were among the most astonishing developments of 2016. Turkey survived a coup attempt, but the event exacerbated a growing autocratic streak by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Brazil hosted a successful Summer Olympics against a precarious political backdrop that culminated in the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff. Here at home, use of excessive lethal force on black men by white police officers has rekindled a debate over racial bias in law enforcement. Meantime, in Dallas, Texas, five white police officers who were trying to keep the peace at a protest over fatal police shootings of black men in Minnesota and Louisiana were shot and killed by an Afghan war veteran. With us to discuss the top global stories of 2016 are two seasoned journalists who are no strangers at these VOA microphones. David Rennie is Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist magazine, and Michael Williams, he's a contributor to CBS Radio. Both are valued panelists on our sister program, Issues in the News, VOA's roundup of the week's top stories. Both gentlemen join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Hello.
Well, David Rennie, let me begin with you to get your take on the top stories of 2016. What struck you this past year?
Well, I think that the single most important word of the single most important four words in Western democratic politics was the word again. And that was at the back of the Donald Trump's successful slogan in the American election, which was "Make America Great Again." And without that word again, "Make America Great," that could be any politician running for office. But that appeal to nostalgia, that appeal to people who feel that they had something good, that it was taken from them, that their birthright includes a whole bunch of things like a well-paid factory job, perhaps, a position in the world, status, economic power, social power, they feel it's been taken from them. And I think that the lesson of 2016 was that in a whole bunch of countries, notably the United States, notably Britain with that vote to leave the European Union, politicians were very, very successful when they said to the people who felt like winners maybe in the 1950s and 1960s, people like white factory workers who got their first really well-paid jobs in that boom period of the post-war years, those people, now old, a lot of them living in places which lost their factories, a lot of them feeling like they don't recognize their country anymore, maybe because of immigration, maybe because of diversity, maybe even things like gay rights. They just feel that the world that they grew up in feels like it's been taken from them. Politicians like Donald Trump, politicians across Europe, were very successful in 2016 when they said, that was taken from you, it was stolen from you, and I, the political strongman, will find the thief, track them down, and set everything back to right.
And emphasis on the word I and only I can fix it, Donald Trump said in 2016 in the run-up to the election.
Certainly. I mean, it's about control. So I think that the big slogan here, as we said, was "Make America Great Again." That appealed to people who feel a strong sense of kind of longing for what they had in the past. In Britain, the vote to leave the European Union, the most powerful slogan was "Take Back Control." If you like, take back control again. That appealed to nostalgia and control.
Michael Williams, what's your big takeaway in 2016?
Well, I think that David is really on the money with what he's saying, that there's a sense of a global redefining of what success and failure really is. In some objective sense, you could say that the post-World War II policies have worked very, very well in these large overarching institutions like NATO, like the UN, the World Bank, the European Union, have done what they were designed to do. They have kept the peace. They've created an environment where growth and relative sense of prosperity could occur. But there is a sense now that those institutions rightly or wrongly, are failing somehow because there's not this sort of ever-expanding economy, that there's this fear of the other that's coming from this extended engagement in the Middle East, that no one is sure what the great benefit of it is, but we're seeing these huge downside with the terrorism and the refugees that are being exported out of that particular conflict. So there's this idea that where are we now? Are we succeeding or are we failing? And as David points out, there's a new breed of politician, or maybe an old breed of politician, the political populist strongman that has been around for centuries. This is not a new thing to have this sort of thing, but these guys are appealing now to a sense of where is mine? There's a lot of indicators. The stock markets say that we're succeeding, but where's mine? I have a sense of loss. The economy recovered, they're telling me, after the recession of 2008. Yeah, GM got theirs, but where's mine? So there's a politician that's appealing and saying, yes, you are right. Something that you had has been taken away. Your money, your culture, your birthright. And they're offering to give it back. Whether or not they have the means to do that and fulfill any of those promises remains to be seen. I think some of it is doubtful. The idea that protectionism creates growth. I mean, some of these things are just contrary to each other. So it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out in these elections that are coming up in 2017 with Germany, with France, with Holland. If you really get populist, strongmen, isolationist, ultra-conservatives running these countries, will they win? And if they win, will they deliver?
Back to you, David Rennie. Michael Williams mentioned the word strongman, populist, and that brings to mind Russia. Donald Trump spoke very fondly of Vladimir Putin during the run-up to the election and says that I'm going to change our relationship with Russia. But most Americans, or at least members of Congress, both Democrats and Republicans, don't see Russia in a very positive light. So let me bring that topic to you, the Russian hacking, the dump to WikiLeaks of the emails, mostly of Democrats, the Democratic National Committee, campaign manager of Hillary Clinton, and then the investigation that's going on right now with the current White House and potentially other investigations in Congress to look at Russian interference in the U.S. election.
Well, this has been a pretty extraordinarily good year for Vladimir Putin, as you say, the president of Russia. If you think how he began the year with his economy really groaning under the weight of international sanctions imposed after Russia's annexation of Crimea in Ukraine. You saw Russia taking a big gamble by putting military forces into the Syrian civil war. You had American officers saying they're going straight into a quagmire. You saw a kind of international unity, Western Europe more unified against Russia than it had been for a very long time because of the shock of Russia's bad behavior in Ukraine and a sense that Europe was willing to be more aggressive in pushing back against Russian bullying on the eastern flank of NATO and the European Union. Now, jump 12 months, and Vladimir Putin seems to have essentially, by sheer force of ruthlessness and a willingness to inflict savage casualties, has actually played a decisive role, not in solving the Syrian civil war, but on one side of the civil war. He's a participant in the Syrian civil war and has helped his side by sheer force of brutality. In terms of international unity, Western unity in the face of Russian bullying is falling apart, led by a president-elect, soon to be president of the United States, who cannot say enough things about Vladimir Putin's strongman view of the world. It's more kind of an embrace of that cynical, sort of nihilistic, trust nothing, rely on fear, sort of nationalist strongman mentality that he seems to admire in Vladimir Putin and Russia. And you're seeing how there's a real divide in America. We thought we understood that American conservatives, that the Republican Party on the right, was essentially suspicious of Russia, didn't trust Russia, put its faith in NATO. We're learning that there's a divide, that there are people inside the Republican Party on the right of American politics who are still classically upset by the idea of Russian meddling and Russian interference, and they see the Western powers as a kind of united bloc. But you're also seeing that there's a group for whom they actually see this as a kind of civilizational class, particularly between Christianity and Islam, that Islam is a kind of force that threatens Western civilization. They think that people like Vladimir Putin know how to deal with Islamic terrorism. And so all of those kind of pieces are being reshuffled as we enter 2017 in a really unexpected, dramatic way.
Michael Williams, regardless of one's opinion or evaluation of Russian President Vladimir Putin, the system, which is obviously an autocratic system, I think anybody should be worried about the hacking of the election, the hacking into the emails of the Democratic National Committee, John Podesta, the campaign manager of Hillary Clinton, and that they did so, and we have proof from our intelligence community, to undermine Hillary Clinton. Now, nobody's saying that the investigations that are going forward are going to in any way upset the result of the election. This has to be very clear. But this is, at root, an effort to undermine the U.S. electoral system. This affects everyone, regardless of party affiliation. To what extent do you think this is a serious story in 2016 and it could have reverberations in 2017?
Certainly a serious story. When you look at the organizations that have investigated this, I think there's almost unanimous agreement that there has been Russian mischief in terms of influencing this election and hacking the Democratic National Committee. I think the only group that doesn't agree with that is the Trump organization slash administration, incoming administration. It sort of goes back to what David was saying about the Russian economy. Russia as a whole, as a country right now, is autocratic, and its economy is in really bad shape. It's a one-trick pony. It's got energy. It sells that energy to Western countries. Its GDP is falling. It's in a very precarious situation as a country by most measures. And I think in lieu of having a quality export other than energy, it is now exporting mischief and conflict into the world and sort of interjecting itself into these international politics and trying to make itself a national player as a way of expanding its influence, if not its wealth. The foray into U.S. politics is just the first of many such, I guess, escapades that he's going to be involved in. I think you see this in the elections in virtually every country in Europe, where you hear reports of the Russians sponsoring neo-Nazi groups to come to conferences and discuss ways to become more politically active and to influence the stronger and larger parties that are at play in their individual countries. This is really a fascinating look at how an autocrat chooses to export his mode of thinking. Say, don't trust your government, don't trust your own neighbor, trust us. And it's a very, I think, dangerous thing what anyone in those parties, and including our own incoming president, if they think that they have a lot in common with the way that Putin is thinking right now, that's probably a dangerous thing for your country. Ultimately, whatever Russia is selling externally on its facade, what eventually you will get is conflict and mischief. And the sooner people understand that, step up and face that challenge and reject it, the better, I think, for the prospects for peace in the world in 2017.
We'll have more in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Encounter on The Voice of America. My guests are David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist magazine, and Michael Williams, from whom you just heard. He's contributor to CBS Radio. We're discussing the top stories of 2016, and this is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. You can send an email to encounter@voanews.com. Tell us where you're from and how you listen to the program. Here's a shout out to M. Ayoubi from Kandahar, Afghanistan. Well, back to you, David Rennie, to talk a bit more about Syria, which you brought up, and of course the fall of Aleppo, thanks to the brute force of Russia, the Air Force, and of course Shiite militias backed by Iran, who backs to the hilt the Bashar al-Assad regime. What's the symbolism of that in your view, and the unfortunate byproduct of this terrible conflict in Syria, the refugees seeking asylum, of course, in Europe, you know, being twice victims in a sense, because they are innocent people, they were bombarded, barrel bombs, attacked by their own regime, seeking refuge. And yet we note that there's a conflation sometimes between asylum seekers, refugees, and terrorists. This perception that actual terrorists from maybe the Islamic State or others have infiltrated, making these poor refugees twice victims.
I think that one of the things we can say, we're sitting here in Washington, D.C., very conscious of American public opinion and Western public opinion and how it operates. One thing we can say about Aleppo is that if you wanted a perfect test of the depressing theory that international public opinion has decided not to care about what happens in Syria, Aleppo has provided it. I mean, you could not have had a more heartbreaking siege and civilian slaughter. You couldn't have had more touching images than the pictures we've all seen in newspapers and on the internet of children from Aleppo looking dazed and terrified after bombings, mass civilian casualties, this kind of brutal medieval scene of slaughter playing out in live sort of TV and internet in front of us. And essentially, the world did not want to act. We did not care enough. Instead, the reaction from a lot of Western politicians has been to say, we don't want these people in our own countries. We don't want Syrian refugees. They're dangerous. We can't trust them. We can't vet them. We can't find out who is in that group. And so I think you've seen essentially the tragedy of Aleppo is telling us something not just about where we are with the Syrian civil war and the durability of the Assad regime. There was a moment in a presidential debate here in America where Donald Trump was asked about Aleppo. And he said, well, I think it's more or less fallen already. Now, when he said those words, it hadn't. But in sort of political terms, it kind of fell the moment he said those words, because that indicated that America was not going to come to the rescue, that there would not be a dramatic change of policy and more arms for rebels, that essentially the world was saying to Aleppo, hurry up and die, because we're kind of not interested. And I think that's what we've learned this year.
Michael Williams, anything to add or subtract to that? The symbolism of Aleppo, the fall of Aleppo, and what it portends for 2017.
Yeah, there's a couple of phrases that leap to mind when you hear diplomats talk. I heard very often during 2016 that there is no military solution to this problem. And I say again that Assad and Putin showed that there is a military solution, and it's relentless killing. That's what they chose to do. And it worked very effectively for them. They did exactly what they wanted to do. The other phrase is that I think in 2005, this sort of doctrine of responsibility to protect was created in the UN as an idea for the idea that governments should protect their own citizens. And if those governments fail to do so, then the international community should somehow get involved and begin to intercede on behalf of those affected citizens. What 2016 made clear to me is that this remains a doctrine and a theory, and it is in no way a governing principle of the United States or any of the international community. It's the community suffers, I think, from a certain military fatigue, especially the United States. I think that President Obama has been extremely reluctant after promising to close Guantanamo and pull out of Iraq and get the U.S. out of the Middle East to jump back in a significant, meaningful way was just anathema to his whole foreign policy, and much to the detriment, I think, of Syria and the Western world. The United States at this moment still is the only power that can step in a military fashion and make that type of difference. And it basically abdicated that role to Russia. And in 2017, it remains to be seen whether the Trump administration will take that back.
Well, that's a very fair point, because even though President-elect Trump has indicated that he's more in line with Russia with respect to Syria, President Obama very much abdicated in the eyes of many. And he just laid the table, one could say, for this incoming administration. So we will have to see. But the implications are probably not very savory, because even though presumably the Assad regime is technically in control of Aleppo and many of the major population centers in Syria, we know that the war will continue in other ways. People will not allow this situation to prevail. David Rennie, any other stories that strike you that either conform to the big themes you spoke about, this notion of nostalgia, again, the strong man coming back? What other stories strike you?
So I think it's not just about nostalgia for the past, but when people are nostalgic for the past, they're nostalgic for an era that people felt that they understood that their kind of their nation state, their region, their town was kind of theirs, and they could control it. And I think that what we saw was 2016 was a year which I think really proved the wisdom of political analysts and politicians who for several years now have been saying that the old labels about left-wing and right-wing in Western politics were not that useful, that actually it was much more of a clash between open and closed, between drawbridge up and sort of turn yourself into a fortress and try and shut out the world, or drawbridge down, trade with the world, have immigration to help your workforce, try and take the benefits of openness. I think that what we saw in 2016, what we will see in 2017, is that a lot of people in the rich Western world, the Western Europe and in the United States, they feel that openness has been a disaster. They don't feel comfortable with the degree of mobility. They don't feel comfortable with the idea of refugees having a right to claim asylum in other countries. They don't feel comfortable with open borders, with immigration as a solution to aging populations. They don't feel comfortable with free trade. They don't feel comfortable with supply chains that mean that you may work for one multinational company in a factory in America, but actually the parts come from a factory in Mexico and your product is finished in a factory in Canada. And economists and experts would say, actually, that's tremendously efficient. That's a good thing. That should be celebrated. That's creating good jobs. But it doesn't mesh with how people feel about themselves in the world. They feel like they've lost control of this world. So I think that 2016 was not just a revolt in sort of terms of nostalgia. People wanted to go back into the past, but it was a revolt against openness. and the idea that you can control and get benefits from openness. And I think that will play out in 2017 economically in terms of free trade. It will play out in terms of the next waves of refugees out of the Middle East. It'll play out in all kinds of elections, as Michael said, that will take place in 2017 in Germany, in France, in the Netherlands, important countries which are going to have elections in 2017. Those themes of open versus closed will, I think, be tremendously important.
Michael Williams, notwithstanding the many difficulties with open trade, immigration, open borders, and so on, it sounds like what David is saying, we're going backwards, really, in a, perhaps a negative direction, because one can always find ways of mitigating the negative effects of immigration or open borders. We know the risks. What do you think?
Well, you know, nostalgia is a powerful thing because it's all based on your imagination of what once was. And when people, especially our politicians and leaders, are pointing towards the past, everyone is reaching for a different point. And so if you say, well, let's make things great again, everyone has a different picture of what's in their mind. But those things don't necessarily mesh in the here and now. They will probably be in conflict. Look, we are going forward. No matter what anybody says, let's go back. We are going forward. You're not going to bring back some of the industries, some of the situations that caused any type of prosperity in the past. We are in a global situation. That's not going to change any more than we're going to bring back whale oil or something like that. Okay, we are moving forward. So I think what's going to be interesting is maybe with all of the political turmoil that's going on and all the political uncertainty, it may be the reviled big businesses and large corporations that provide stability for us going forward because they are very much cognizant of the trade, the infrastructure, the realities of global trade and openness that allow prosperity to exist. And there'll probably be some pushbacks with these corporations that make sure that the populist and the protectionists don't go overboard in their zeal for populist approval. So it's going to be interesting to see how companies like Exxon, who now has a seat at the table, potentially the Secretary of State with the U.S. government, these types of large companies and large structures affect the political climate rather than vice versa, as it's been in the past.
And as we close, just a quick word about the global strategic landscape. David Rennie, Turkey cozying up to Russia, notwithstanding the recent assassination of the Russian ambassador in Ankara. Is there a risk that Turkey will be moving away from NATO, moving closer to Russia and that alliance? What are your thoughts on the global strategic landscape?
I think there'll be two big shifts potentially in the global strategic landscape as far as, say, Russia and its influence are concerned. One is just a sheer willingness to act, a level of ambition. I think one thing that we're seeing with all these debates about open versus closed is countries just don't have the ambition to be particularly active outside their own borders. This is a very much an inward-looking, resentful, exhausted kind of time in politics. And so the idea of countries banding together to try and fix the world beyond their borders, I think, is going to be very weak in 2017. The other thing that's going to be very complicated is there was a triangle for a long time that we understood between Europe, America, and Russia. And basically, America and Europe were in alliance against Russia. But you would sometimes see the leaders of big countries like France and Germany several times during the Cold War thinking, well, you know, we should hedge a bit. We should get a bit closer to Russia because we don't want America to be the big bullying sort of hegemon. That triangle is completely shifted if what happens is the new American president and Russia of finding common cause in terms of a kind of brutal, sort of cynical, take-no-prisoners approach to Islamic terrorism, and a sort of squeamish Europe is the one saying, well, hang on, you're empowering Russia, Russia frightens us. If that triangle sort of completely shifts so that it's the axis is America and Russia getting together and frightening Europe, that would be a really dramatic shift in the post-war order.
Well, the last word to you, Michael Williams, but what David Rennie just said reminded me of a phrase I heard recently. Angela Merkel is becoming the leader of the free world.
Yes, yes.
If indeed Russia and the United States come closer, values of which couldn't be more diametric, but we'll see.
We really will see. You mentioned Turkey and Russia. I mean, the idea of this peace accord that's supposedly going on between Russia and Turkey and Iran.
And Iran.
Trying to get together to solve a Middle East peace price, as the psalmist said, pause and think of that.
With the United States nowhere at the table.
Yeah.
I'm afraid on that rather dubious note, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Michael Williams of CBS Radio and David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief of The Economist magazine. Gentlemen, thanks so much for coming in, sharing your insights.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week and next year for another Encounter on The Voice of America.